Coming to you from a post-apocalyptic frozen yogurt stand, it's the Liberal Arts.
A podcast about postgraduate life and the things we would study if someone were paying us.
Please, somebody pay us.
I'm Science.
I'm Cleo.
And I'm Rissa.
Oh, it's good to hear your dulcet voices.
Yours too. It's not like we haven't been talking for the past half hour before we started recording this.
Even so, I'm glad that you guys are here with me to hear my awesome fun fact that I have. Would you like a fun fact?
Yes, please.
Alright, so this fun fact requires some background. So, in 1601...
1601. Wait, I gotta put this in context. 1601. Shakespeare was alive, right?
Yes,
probably. 4 years before the gunpowder plot.
Yeah, 6 years before the founding of Jamestown.
Meanwhile, in New Mexico.
Not where I thought this would go.
70 Spaniards, plus an entourage, led by a man named Juan de Oñate, traveled from New Mexico to the northeast in order to look for the Seven Cities of Gold. As you do.
Nice. Did he find it?
Wait for it.
Okay.
No, he did not find the Seven Cities of Gold.
I mean, I didn't expect them to.
Yeah, no, they were probably a myth made up by Native Americans to waste Spanish time.
Nice.
waste her time, 1601.
It's the ancient version of clickbait.
Right? What they found instead was a massive city. This city was by two rivers, and they called it Etzanoa.
Okay.
Then, when I say massive, I mean that they estimated that there were 20,000 people living there.
Oof. Wow. Okay, when you say they went northeast, where did they end up relative to today's geography?
I think Kansas.
Kansas?
Oh, wow, okay.
Yes.
So, like, the middle.
They went through the Panhandle, Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas, that kind of area. Where was I? Oh yeah, so they found this massive city, and they called the people who lived there the Rayados, because they, Rayados means like striped or streaked, and they had like either paint or tattoos on their faces that were in stripes. And the Rayados were not pleased to see them, and fought them, and so these 70 Spaniards tried to lob cannonballs at a city of 20,000 people, and were just overwhelmed by waves and waves of fighters.
Dang. You don't say.
Yeah, they had to retreat. Needless to say, they had to retreat. Most people think that this story is fake, because 20,000 people, a city of 20,000 people in the middle of the American Plains sounds made up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It feels like we would have found ruins and things.
Right. Guess what?
We did!
They found it.
Yes!
Yay!
They found it in April, actually.
Really? Wow.
Oh, yeah. The people of Arkansas City have been digging up Native American...
I'm sorry, Arkansas City?
Arkansas City, Kansas. City.
Arkansas City, Kansas.
It's on the Arkansas River.
What has this world come to?
Quit your belly aching. It's on the Arkansas River.
In Kansas.
In Kansas. So in April, this guy from Wichita State, named Donald Blakesley, he had been talking to the people of Arkansas City, and he said that they had been digging up Native American artifacts, like literal tons is what he said, of Native American artifacts for years. And so they knew that a lot of Native Americans
lived in this. Wait, what did they do with it?
Did they just toss it? He was talking to locals, so they probably kept it, or they donated it to museums, or whatever. Okay. The point is that no one was keeping a record of exactly how much they were digging up.
Okay.
So he and a high schooler named Adam Ziegler went to a place in between two of the rivers, the Walnut and the Arkansas City, or I'm sorry, the Arkansas River, that they thought was described in one of the first-hand accounts of the Spaniards, and they took a metal detector and they started wandering around, and they found Spanish cannonballs.
Whoa!
Yeah, so...
Dude.
They're excavating the site now, and they are finding significant evidence of this massive city that was once that once existed here. They think it was probably the Wichita natives.
That's awesome.
That who lived there. So yeah. Anyway, the idea that Plains Indians were like all nomadic and like a completely hunter-gatherer society is a fallacy.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah, that's my fun fact for today.
That is a very... Yeah. Can you please link to that on the blog? Because I definitely want to read more about it.
I will absolutely really link cool. to this on that the page. That was really cool. Rissa, do you have a colloquium for us today?
I do. I have what is really the last of this little mini-series I'm doing on kind of giving a biography of Joan of Arc.
Sad day.
Well, I mean, we're not going to leave the subject completely. We can talk a little later about what I might do next. I'd quite like to keep talking about Joan, but turn more towards how Joan has been portrayed. Whereas today I'm kind of finishing up just the straight history part. Before we start, I did want to just start by apologizing. this isn't apologizing for what I'm going to say, although a little bit of that. I'm just going to start by repeating a bit of what I said when I first started this series, which is, I'm very sorry that I am not French. I have been informed by my reliable sources, aka friends who speak French, that none of the pronunciations I have given for any place name in this entire series have been at all coherent or good. So, I'm very sorry that I cannot pronounce French words or French place names, and that every time I try, it just sounds like I'm doing it bad on purpose. I'm not. I'm just really bad at this.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
So, yes, I wanted to start by giving that caveat and apology again. I don't think I have too many place names in this one, but I have a few, and I'm already looking at them like, I don't want to say that. So far, I've done two talks about Joan of Arc, first as a visionary and second as a warrior. Today I'm going to talk about Saint Joan of Arc as a martyr. Joan of Arc is actually, and I couldn't confirm she was the only one, but if she's not the only one, she's one of the only people who is a Roman Catholic saint who was excommunicated and burnt as a heretic by the Roman Catholic Church. That's not normal. There are lots of martyrs. Lots of martyrs that are saints. But most of them weren't killed by the church. And because of that, it actually took her a very long time to become a saint. And we'll talk about that at the end. But she, technically, I think she was killed by the English, but only after she was, you know, tried by the church and condemned by the church and all that kind of stuff. So
that's weird. Why does she kill the... I'm sure you'll explain.
I will. We're getting ahead of ourselves now. But it is just an interesting story of... it's very abnormal for a martyr to be killed by the church, basically. And that's not to say she's the only one, but...
Or at least to be acknowledged by the same church that martyred them.
Yes, exactly. I believe she's actually also recognized by the Anglican Church, which is funny because she, you know, fought the English, but we'll get to that later. And I'm not going to be able to tell you everything we know because we have so many records. We have a shocking amount. I've read all of the first-hand accounts that I could find, and there's just so many. This is a very high-profile case, and they took a lot of notes, and we still have a lot of them. And a lot of the stuff I've already shared with you, especially about Joan's visions, actually comes from these documents. But I don't actually want to skip straight to the trial.
Yeah, how'd she get from a venerated war hero?
Yeah, so last time, I think I ended by saying a little bit about her capture. So on the 23rd of March in 1430, Joan was about 18 years old, which still baffles my mind, by the way. And she was riding with the men under her command to a place that I'm now going to attempt pronouncing. she was riding to... now I'm really self-conscious about it.
Dude, just go with it. It's like
Compiègne. Compiègne.
Campaign.
No.
Champagne.
She's writing to a city in France to provide support. So they knew that this city was going to be sieged by the English, and they were going to get there first and try to protect the city. But outside of the city gates, Joan was cut off from her party, ambushed, and surrounded by the Burgundians. Now, remember, the Burgundians are people serving the Duke of Burgundy, an area of what is now northeastern France, and they are allies of the English against the French. So, these people surround her and demand her surrender. Joan refuses to surrender, and one of the archers pulls her off of her horse. And forces her to surrender, basically.
But they don't shoot her. That's interesting.
No, they definitely do not shoot her. But the killing of nobles is not common in these wars. Ransoms are what's, you know, the rule of the day, really.
I forgot that she was made a noble.
Yes, she was ennobled. But in any case, she's such an important figure, she would have been held for ransom, and she was held for ransom, actually. So she was captured by the Burgundians. Because this capture happened when she was separated from her rear guard, some people at the time speculated that she may have been betrayed from within the French ranks, which is something that Joan once said was the only thing that she feared. We really don't know what exactly happened that got her stranded the way she was and ambushed. But after her capture, she was imprisoned by the Burgundians and moved around a few times. She was moved north of the contested area. And we know that Dunois and Lahire, two of the commander of Orléans and the captain of the French mercenaries, actually led four separate campaigns to try and rescue her, none of which succeeded.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow.
Now, there is one interesting story I hadn't heard before that I do want to talk about before we get to the trial, because it's referred to in the trial, and it was one of those stories, like, I've never heard this. How have I never heard this? How do people tell this without telling this story? Because it's just, I think it's very interesting. Okay. People normally talk about Joan being captured by the English. That's not true. She was captured by the Burgundians and sold to the English as a prisoner of war. Like I said, she was held for ransom, but instead of selling her to the French, which I don't think the French didn't have the money to buy her, basically. They sold her to the English, who definitely did have the money. But while she was in Burgundian custody, Joan was moved around to several different prisons, mostly because she kept trying to escape. Later, the English and the church kind of tried to chastise her, basically tried to use that whole guilty people don't run type of thing, and she was like, I was in prison. Everyone tries to escape prison.
Not just that, she was a prisoner of war. You guys were the enemy's side. Like, yeah.
So one of these stories is remarkable. At one point, now the record and the details of this change a little bit, even within the time it seems that there were different stories going around. And I think Joan at one point remarked about how the story changed. Joan leapt out of a tower, reported to be 70 feet high, and survived by landing in a dry moat.
Ow.
Ah, how did she live?
I don't actually know. Now, she was asked at the time if she jumped in an attempt to end her life, if this was suicide, and she said no, it wasn't. That she had commended herself to God before jumping, and so she did not expect to die.
Oh my gosh.
So there's something. She said that she jumped because she heard that the Burgundians were killing the people of France, and she thought she could help, and she could basically hear them from the tower because they were in a nearby town, and she hated being in prison while French blood was spilled, and so that's why she tried to escape at that point. She also said, however, that jumping from the tower was one of the only times that she has directly disobeyed the saints who visited her, Margaret and Catherine, that they told her not to, and she did anyway, but that afterwards she asked for their forgiveness and received their forgiveness. Huh. So yeah, that story comes up because they ask her if she ever disobeyed the saints, and that was the story she tells.
Interesting.
Yeah. I just love that image of someone jumping from an insanely high tower and then being like, no, I didn't expect to die, and she didn't. So... more power to her.
That's, what do you think I'm curious, were they trying to use the suicide accusation against her? Because I know that suicide was considered a sin at the time, like a mortal sin.
They don't seem to have pressed the issue. So I was going to get to this a bit later, but a lot of what they tried her on boils down to submission to the church, submission to authority. Something like trying to escape from prison is an act of rebellion against the authority that's put you in prison. So it was more invoked on that kind of thing. The suicide was kind of just a side note more.
Hmm.
Yeah, and they seem to believe her when she says, "No, I was not suicidal." They seem to be satisfied with that. They don't really press it.
More concerned that she is obedient than that she is suicidal.
Mm-hmm. As long as you do what you're
told. I mean, it would save them a lot of trouble if she died by her own hand. Or legs jumping. Anyway, but the Burgundians did sell Joan to the English, who moved her to Rouen, which is in northwestern France, very securely within the English territory. And that's where the rest of the story will take place, really. Joan never left the city. She was tried by Bishop Pierre Cochon, who was French, but heavily allied with the English throughout the Hundred Years' War. Now, I don't really know what this guy's deal was, but...
I have a question.
Yeah.
Is his last name Pig? Is his last name Pig?
It's C-A-U-C-H-O-N.
Okay, all right. It's not quite Pig. Hello, I am Bishop Pig.
I mean, that would have... There would have been a lot of caricature there. I don't really want to know... No, I don't really know what this guy's deal was, people have villainized him, and I think, actually, in the inquiry afterwards, he was found to be at fault and basically blamed, and I don't remember exactly what happened to him, but, like, the church was not happy with him after this. But even before this, there is record of a lot of kind of corruption and bribery and other charges against this guy for previous dealings. I don't know how much of that was confirmed. He's not really my topic. I didn't really do a lot of research on what he ended up, but he's not a great guy. We know this.
Gotcha.
I have a question.
He's very biased. Yes.
And you may get into this later. Okay, so where is the Pope and on whose side is he?
He's in Italy, and I don't think he takes a side in this war. In fact, Joan, at the beginning of the trial, Joan tries to invoke the Pope and say, kind of, you don't have the authority to decide this case, but the Pope would. I would listen to him. And they're just like, nah, it would take too much time to ask him. Even though they held her for over a year. Jeez. So
basically what we're dealing with is that the local bishops are choosing to ally themselves with whatever people are in authority in their area and making church decisions based on that?
Kind of, yeah.
When we say that she was excommunicated by the church, we mean just the bishops in league with England.
Well, no, there was a group of people appointed to be her judges, chief of whom was this Pierre Cochon. All of them were clergymen and bishops, and I think one of them might actually have been an inquisitor. I'm not sure on that front. What we would, like, it's hard to say nationality. They spoke French, they were from what we call France, but that doesn't mean that they were allied with the king who was crowned at Reims, you know?
Right.
And they did a lot of kind of trial sessions. She had a lot of hearings, some of them public, a lot of them private. There were a lot of investigations and interrogations. Like I said, she was in custody for over a year. Not all of that was under the English, but most of it was.
When you say we have all these firsthand accounts,
mm-hmm.
who's writing them?
The, like, court scribes, I assume.
Oh, they're play-by-plays.
Yeah, these are legal documents. These are accounts of the, like, it's a dialogue.
Very interesting. Okay.
Yeah. Joan was charged with a lot of things, including heresy, witchcraft, and cross-dressing.
one of and these pants. Things is not like the other.
Yeah.
To us.
Keep an eye on that one. I was wrong. So the trial itself properly only lasted about 3 months, but she was in prison for over a year. And so Joan's imprisonment and her trial were unusual, and even by the standard of her day, and even in wartime, really unfair, and recognized as such by some of the people at the time. So Joan wasn't kept in a church prison, even though she was being tried by a church court. If she were kept in a church prison, she would have been attended to and guarded by nuns, most likely, but she wasn't. She was kept in an English prison, guarded by men, by soldiers. Ooh. And chained by her feet to a large block of wood. This will become a little more important later, but basically she was in pretty poor conditions. There's a couple records of her getting sick a few times while she was in prison. And of course, like I said, all of her judges were rather pro-English and Burgundian clerics, overseen by the nearby English commanders who imprisoned Joan, because she was also a prisoner of war. During the trial, no witnesses were ever actually called against Joan. It wasn't really that kind of trial. Instead, the judges basically just spent the entire time trying to manipulate Joan into testifying against herself.
That seems, listen, I'm no lawyer, but that seems like a waste of time.
Yeah.
She's pretty solid in her beliefs, right? Like, wouldn't it be easy to just call someone up and say, hey, did you see her set that bridge on fire from Fires from Hell that one time? Yeah, that was definitely witchcraft.
Also, the actual bishops trying her didn't technically have the jurisdiction to do it. So there was a lot of kind of reasons that even at the time people said, hey, this is abnormal.
Okay, so the bishop trying her didn't have the jurisdiction. Who did? The Pope?
It may have been one of the bishops that was now allied with the French that they didn't want to involve.
Like the archbishop kind of guy.
Yeah. There was definitely, one of the archbishops was definitely on Charles' side. I don't actually know the answer to that question.
Oh.
But... So, I remember where we were, sorry. You asked about... I said that Joan's trial was mostly them trying to get her to condemn herself for heresy. A lot of that was... They were basically trusting that she would just start saying heretical things as soon as she was questioned, or mix up her stories, or something like that.
They didn't believe her.
But they also kind of... Because this is a church trial, instead of calling witnesses and saying, basically, Joan is the enemy and we're going to treat her like that, some of it was actually sold as kind of a, we need to help this wayward child back to the correct ways of the church.
Oh, that's almost worse.
It's a lot worse. So that's where most of this manipulation comes in. Okay, but the trial itself, there's a lot of very interesting stories about this trial. And one of the things I find most interesting that comes up first is actually how seriously Joan takes oaths. She's like 18, 19, and she takes these really, really seriously. So every day in the courtroom, she was supposed to be sworn in. We still do this. We still swear people into courtrooms. It's not the exact same oath, but, you know, that oath to... tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Basically, right. They wanted her to swear something like that, and she was very hesitant to, because she took oaths super seriously. And she had already taken an oath to God and to her king, Charles, that there was certain information she could not share, because it was a secret between her and the king. You know, military secrets.
Gotcha.
She's very aware that these people aren't on her side, and she can't tell the whole truth.
That
would be
to
betraying
me.
Something that she has already sworn to.
Huh.
So in the end, she does take an oath to swear to tell everything pertinent to the case.
I think that's interesting because Joan is always portrayed either as a helpless waif martyr or as a feminist girl power icon, and like the fact that this is her trial, so I would expect it to be more martyr waif kind of dynamic, but she's not naive about any of this.
Oh no, not at all. In fact, she's extremely astute, especially for, like, you know, an illiterate farm girl. We're gonna get into some of the stuff she said, but some of it is like it impressed her judges. It impressed me. It's insane how astute some of her answers are. In fact, what I was getting to with the pertinent to your case thing is that a lot of Joan's answers, like I might go so far as to say almost a majority of Joan's answers, are basically saying either one, that's not pertinent to your case, I don't have to tell you, please stop asking, or two, mm-hmm. I already said that, please refer to my previous answer. They tried a lot to get Joan to contradict herself. Like, that's what they were really relying on, was that her heresy would fall through and make her contradict herself. And so a lot of her answers are basically either saying, I told you yesterday, please refer to what I said yesterday, or saying, this was already covered at the investigation at Poitiers, which they had records of at the time. We no longer have them. But she refers to them saying, I already testified to this, you know, a few months ago. You have the record. Please refer to that. My answer has not changed.
That's awesome.
She's very astute. She knows that they're trying to trap her. And she's frustratingly good at getting out of it. At least they would say it was frustrating. I think it's awesome. But yeah, that, like I said, she takes oaths very seriously. She takes that she is telling the truth very seriously. And she also takes her privacy very seriously. There was a lot of things, especially about her voices, which she said she had not been given leave to share. Some of those things were secrets between her and the king, maybe like military secrets or secrets about his own spiritual life. Mm-hmm. And then other things that were kind of secrets between her and God. Now they questioned her on everything. Like I said, almost everything I told you about her childhood and her visions, we know from these questions. They questioned her about her banner and her ring. They were actually really, really interested in this banner and ring. They both just said the names Jesus and Mary, or just Jesus Maria on them. But they were really curious. They asked a lot of questions that basically questioned whether these things were magic or whether Joan thought they were magic.
Okay, so they're more likely to believe that this banner has some kind of divine or magic property than they are to believe that this girl has some kind of divine or magic property.
I think they were more testing if Joan thought they were magic.
Interesting.
But also, because they're not looking for God's magic, right? They're looking for the devil's magic.
Oh, yes, okay.
Yes, so they're wondering if Joan thinks they're magic or whether... there is any kind of demon using these objects to give her demon power and things like that.
We need to get on exercising this dang banner. It's evil.
Exercising?
Yeah, like an exorcism.
Okay, it just...
Exercising with an O.
With an O. Okay.
Well, I remember in relation to that, when we studied this, Rissa, in our Middle Ages history class, we studied some of the trial transcripts. And our professor pointed out to us that the big deal for them, even with the voices, was not trying, you know, if she had gone to trial to date, we would have been like, is she hearing voices or is she mentally ill?
Mm-hmm.
They never questioned that she heard voices. Their question was, what kind of voices did she hear? Who were they?
Exactly. That's exactly right. They didn't really question that she heard somebody. They just all insisted that the voice couldn't have been from God and was therefore probably from the devil.
Interesting.
So that's the real question.
She was evil, not crazy.
Exactly. And, I mean, they might have thought she was just naive and being used by demonic forces, but still.
Thus the whole, we must save this poor child.
Yes. But yes, they asked her about all of this kind of thing. And, some of the really funny sections come from these questions. One of my favorite questions they asked was about her visions of the Archangel Michael and his appearance. They asked her for lots of details about exactly what she saw, and basically trying to press her to say something which they would have viewed as not something that would have been right to say about the saints or angels.
Like something irreverent?
Yeah, or just... that they appeared in a way that they shouldn't have. And there were lots of records of saints seeing angels and saints, right? So they were kind of trying to compare her visions to the ones that they believed were legit.
Gotcha.
And yeah, also trying to get her to contradict herself, that kind of thing. So the more detail they ask for, the more room there is for her to contradict herself. Right. But at one point they ask if he, when he appeared to her, did he have long hair? And she answered, I do not see why it should be cut. And then they asked, this is my favorite, they asked her if he took on the appearance of a naked man, to which Joan replied, do you think that God has not the wherewithal to clothe him? So, yeah, you get some of the kind of wit that you from these questions that are actually really fun. Some of this has led to people wondering how much of the details here Joan kind of makes up to answer these questions and how much she really witnessed. Like I said, I don't know. It's not like I'm not in any position to say, but they really do press her for, like, exactly what did you see? Which is interesting because not a lot of her visions don't seem to be very visual. There's mostly a voice and maybe something as vague as a light when it comes to visual stuff. But in the end, the thing that really got them was that in these visions, the people who visited her told her to wear men's clothes and to continue doing so. And because they thought this was definitely, obviously sinful, if the visions were from God, he wouldn't have told her to do it. So obviously the visions weren't from God.
Right.
That's basically how they came down on the visions, is that they were obviously from the devil because they told her to wear pants. That's not okay. Yeah, so you can see how circular a lot of this was.
Right.
Oh, one of the other points they were concerned about was why the angels spoke to Joan in French and not in Latin. Obviously, they did this because Joan spoke French and not Latin. But it is interesting, there wasn't a French translation of the Bible at the time. So right. It was seen as very right and proper for God to speak in Latin and not French. And it's notable that Joan's banner and ring that I mentioned both have Jesus and Mary in French, not in Latin.
Interesting.
Yeah, or at least the banner does. The ring might have actually just had initials, which probably would have been the same in either, but the banner at least had the names in French.
I was going to say, so conveniently, the only people in this whole trial who should be qualified to hear the visions are the people trying to kill Joan.
Oh,
because they speak Latin.
Yes. Oh, yes. You mean if the visions had been in Latin?
Yeah.
Yes.
But they weren't. That's interesting.
Then they could have just been like, well, how do you know God said that? You don't speak Latin.
Yeah, right? Basically, yeah, just this idea that this person who was not part of the church and not trained in these things could say, God said this, was just not okay for them. It upset everything. Like I said, I was going to get this later, and I mentioned it slightly before, but a lot of this was really about authority. So yeah, when we get down to the meat of this, a lot of this is about submission. The church wants Joan to submit to the church. And eventually, they eventually ask her, like, do you submit to the church? And she says, yes, I submit to the church, but God must be served first. And they were like, so you don't submit to the church? And she's like, oh no, I do submit to the church, God being served first. And the thing about saying this is that just to say this inherently says that serving the church and serving God are not necessarily the same thing. And that it is possible to serve God apart from serving the church, and essentially that the church is not God's only mouthpiece when it comes to what his will is. Wow. Yeah. Joan that's insisted like, that... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
That takes so much guts! And I know she's got guts! Like, she walks into battles for fun, she jumps off towers, but, like, I can't even imagine. Mm-hmm. Like, guts! Oh, I love her.
Me too. So yeah, Joan insisted that her voices never told her to disobey the church, but to serve God first and foremost. That was her sticking
point. Didn't her voices at the beginning tell her to go to church?
Yeah, that was one of the first things they told her was go to church. So yeah, she has a lot of respect for the church, and some of that will really comes out in a bit. I did want to tell this. There's one story that I really want to tell because it's my very favorite exchange, definitely the most kind of pointed exchange of this whole trial. is when they ask her a trick question. So everyone knew at the time, basically, that this was a trick question as well. They asked her, do you believe yourself to be in God's grace? What this means is basically, if you died right now, like, you were positive that, you know, you've done right and stuff. It seems like a fine question, but if Jones says no, it's a confession of sin. Saying, I'm not in God's grace, is a confession of sin. But if Jones says yes, then the judges would be able to say that Joan claimed knowledge that no one but God should have, who is in God's grace, and was therefore blaspheming.
I hate this question.
Yes, it's a terrible question. So she's either going to blaspheme or she's going to confess. Those are the only two options to this yes-no question. And wow. Joan answers, if I am not, may God put me there. And if I am, may God so keep me.
Oh, she's so good.
She's so good. It's very good.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So a lot of the now I've probably told you kind of the most poignant, best quotes from the trial, but a lot of the questions were like this, y'all. She was amazingly astute when it came to these trick questions. But yeah, this trial went on and on and on, and they repeated a lot of this stuff, and Joan asks for respite a lot of the time, between the conditions she was living in and just the stress of her standing alone before these, like, I don't know, 40 men who all want to condemn her. It just kept going. And near the end of her trial, Joan was actually threatened with torture, and we have a record that she was shown the devices for it.
Oh my gosh.
But they were never used. Basically, they said, that's kind of wasteful. She's basically going to condemn herself anyway. We don't really have to do this to get a confession. Wow.
That's both insulting and abusive.
Well, it's a little true, because 2 weeks later, they threatened her with fire, saying, we're gonna skip the torture. We're just gonna burn you. And they were pretty ready to burn her as a heretic. And under this threat, Joan did something I didn't expect. She confessed. She submitted and signed a document of abjuration.
She essentially confessed to exactly?
She recanted of the sin of lying, heresy, inciting violence, consorting with demons, blasphemy, cross-dressing. She signed a document that said, basically, I recognize that I have sinned in all of these ways, I recant and won't do it again, and submit myself to the judgment of the church.
Oh.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, Joan later claimed that she had not understood the full extent of this document, and, well, like, she couldn't read it, it had to be read to her, and said that she had signed under extreme duress, under fear of the fire, and that she had also signed under the promise that if she did sign, she would be freed. So Joan later would say, I signed this under extreme duress, I didn't mean it, it doesn't count. And because of this abjuration, Joan was not immediately killed. Heresy like this, after repentance, like what she signed, is only a capital offense if it's repeated. But they didn't free her either, which Joan was under the impression that they would. Instead, they decided that it'd be better to imprison her for life in the same prison she was in.
What?
Well, that's great.
So they took her back. They cut her hair off, insisting that this time she allow it to grow back to a proper female length. And they made her change into proper female clothes. And she did. For a bit.
Okay.
4 days later, one of them went back in to check on Joan and found that she was again wearing men's clothes. And there's a lot of theories as to why, actually. Joan herself says that she chose it freely, but other people say that she was forced. Some people say that she wasn't even really provided with women's clothes, that she didn't have a choice in the matter, that the only clothes available were men's. Most theories are basically just that being a woman, chained up, guarded by men, while wearing a dress, is exceedingly dangerous, especially for someone known as the maid, who the English called the whore. Just a bad, bad situation all over.
Yeah.
So, she was found to be wearing men's clothing. Now, the problem with this is that she had already confessed to wearing men's clothing and recanted from that terrible thing. Because of this, she was now relapsed. And because she had relapsed on cross-dressing, they were able to open up a trial as a relapsed heretic. Which is a significantly more dangerous thing to be, as this time, if a relapsed heretic is convicted, it is immediate excommunication and execution. Just
yikes.
Done. And this time, it was a lot shorter, because basically Joan said, yeah, I did that. because she claimed that she had never meant to confess to anything like this. She had never meant to do all the things that they said she signed. She said that she still believed and talked to the saints. She still received visions from God. She still believed that they were saints and they definitely weren't demons. She still believed everything that she had at the start of this, that whatever she had signed, it was under such duress that she didn't know what she was doing and she didn't mean it.
Wow.
Because of this, on the 30th of May in 1431, when she was 19 years old, Joan of Arc was excommunicated and handed over to the English authorities, who burnt her at the stake. Before the execution, a sermon was read, and Joan was given the opportunity to speak and give her final words. It said that she forgave her judges and asked everyone present to pray for her. There's a couple stories about, like, as she was being led away, people giving her, a wooden cross to wear, and that she asked two of the clergy to follow her and hold up a crucifix so that she could look at it while she was dying, until, so she was burnt on a very raised platform that they had to climb up, basically, to hold this for her, and in the end she could tell the flames were getting too high, so she asked them to back away so that they wouldn't get hurt. It said that after the crucifix was removed from her sight, she looked up to heaven and cried out the name of Jesus as she died. Mm. Several of Joan's executioners were moved by her death, including the executioner himself, who said that he greatly feared that he would be damned as he had burnt a saint.
Wow.
He literally said those words?
Yeah. Which is interesting, seeing as she definitely wasn't a saint yet.
Yeah, and wouldn't be for centuries, right?
Yeah, but apparently he could tell.
Wow.
Even so, the English were very, very careful to not leave any relics behind. While she was still burning but had already died, the English actually gave instruction to rake the fire down to make sure they could display her burnt remains. They did this for a few reasons. One, to make sure everybody knew that she was, in fact, a woman. And two, to make sure that everybody knew that she was, in fact, dead. Very, very dead. Definitely not passed out. Very dead.
That's messed up.
After this, they continued to let her body burn to ashes, and then burnt the ashes some more, and then threw the ashes into the river. They really Jeez. Did not want relics. They knew that people would try to venerate Joan. Even when they killed her, they knew. Basically, the English kind of didn't want the French to make her into a martyr in the proverbial sense, and she was a martyr in both senses.
Jeez. Do we know anything about the French response to this?
Well, we know that after Joan died, the Hundred Years' War continued for 22 more years, but that Charles VII remained King of France. And 25 years after her excommunication, so 3 years after the war ended, Pope Calixtus III, at the request of Joan's mother and her brothers, opened a retrial, an investigation into Joan's life and her trial, which in the end nullified Joan's excommunication and declared her a martyr, and condemned the bishop who had tried her for
corruption. Was that guy even still alive?
Yeah, I think so. I don't remember. Several people were dead, but at the time of the retrial, there were several key people still alive. I think Lahir had died, but Dunois was definitely there. We have, like, first-hand account statements of Dunois from that retrial. We have statements from her brother and everyone who was related to her that was still alive that basically testified to Joan's virtue and truth and how she was poorly treated and the miracles she had done and that kind of thing. So a lot of the story that I shared earlier a lot of that is actually from the retrial accounts.
Interesting.
Yeah. They did this big thing. They went back to Domremy and, like, asked around everyone who ever knew her. And then they looked over all the records, and they were the people that were like, hey, this guy doesn't actually have jurisdiction to do this, and also, she was imprisoned wrong, and also, they never called any witnesses, and hey, you know, all that kind of thing. They noticed.
So, was Pope Calixtus the Pope at the time of her trial?
I don't believe so. I believe that he was the successor of the Pope that was the Pope at the time of her trial.
And did the king testify at this retrial?
It wasn't an event, so it wasn't like an event where they gathered everybody. They sent out, like, investigators to go ask people. And, you know, I don't remember reading Charles VII's statements on the matter. People from his court surely did. It may have been, I don't know. Charles did, however, support the retrial, basically because everyone knew that Joan kind of made him king, as it were, and if he were made king by a heretic, that's very bad for him. Yeah. But if he were made king by a martyr, that was very good for him.
Yeah.
So he did support the retrial and that kind of stuff. So he if he testified, I don't specifically remember it, but to be honest, I wrote this several months ago.
Did Charles live through the Hundred Years' War? Did he live past it?
Yeah.
We see the end?
Yeah, he continued being king. 1431, 19 years old, she is excommunicated and executed. 25 years later, she is retried, found innocent, and her excommunication is nullified, and she is declared a martyr. 500 years after that, in the year of our Lord, 1920... Joan of Arc was finally canonized a saint of the Roman Catholic Church.
Why did it take so long?
Probably because she was killed by the church.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah. The thing that kind of... some of this research I did for an undergrad paper years ago, but the thing that really got me back into this was a performance I got to see of George Bernard Shaw's play St. Joan, which was actually written in 1921, the year after Joan was canonized. And basically that's why he wrote it. One of the things I actually want to talk about, and like I said, the next one of these I want to do, now that, I mean, there's not too much story to tell about Joan. I told you how she died already.
Yeah.
And what happened 500 years after that. I do want to talk about kind of Joan's influence. Now, I'm not going to cover all the influence Joan has ever had, because there's a lot of it. Basically, because this is a podcast of the things we would study, I'm going to cover the stuff I find interesting. And I want to start with this play.
I can't wait to hear it.
But yeah, this is the end of my almost 10,000 word biography of St. Joan of Arc.
Oh my gosh, it has been a wild ride, and I've learned so much from this.
I'm
glad.
Cleo, do you have a postgrad problem for us?
I do. I have so many problems. No, but I do have a postgrad problem. While there are problems that are specific to different stages of life, I'm learning that some of those problems really could just be the same old problem that is resurfacing in a different way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those is a problem that I discovered in myself during undergrad,
mm-hmm.
that I thought I was going to get rid of once I graduated.
We were so naive.
So naive. But I was recently reading a blog post by a girl I knew in high school about shame and put-togetherness, and I was like, you know, it really tapped into things that I had been mulling around in my head, and I decided it's probably time to talk about this. Because hopefully I'm not the only one. That problem is called imposter syndrome.
Oh, yes.
Yeah!
Definitely not the only one.
No, you're not.
So, for people who don't know what this term means, imposter syndrome was coined by two psychologists, Pauline Clance and Suzanne Imes, in 1978. And it is described as a feeling of phoniness in people who believe that they are not intelligent, capable, or creative, despite evidence of high achievement. While these people are highly motivated to achieve, they also live in fear of being found out or exposed as frauds.
Yes.
Yes. So, yes. Again, for me in undergrad, this showed up mainly academic. Oh no, I can't write this paper. I can't take this class because I'm not smart enough. I'm not capable enough. And people are eventually going to figure that out and think that I'm dumb.
Well, we all know that this is blatant lies.
Yes. We know it's a lie. But for some reason, we still believe it.
Yes. I mean, I definitely have this as well. Oh, hey, I guess we haven't mentioned this on the show. I'm very sorry I am taking your moment, but guys, I have a degree now.
Woohoo! Hey!
I have 2 degrees, actually.
We read your comments. They're very good comments.
They're
your
wonderful.
Professors liked it a
I
lot.
I am amazed. But I passed! I passed!
You did it!
I haven't technically graduated yet, because that's like a ceremony I don't have time for. But, No, seriously, I have just received my final mark and my official pass from a Bachelor of Philosophy in Philosophy from Oxford University, and I still feel like I don't deserve it, despite the fact that it's been 2 years of very hard struggle and learning. And it's because of this. It's because of that just feeling of, like, oh no, they're going to find out that I don't really deserve this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the real feeling.
I feel like I struggle with this in a different way, because I'm pretty sure of myself, guys. You know this.
Which isn't bad.
No, it's not. It's not. But I am well aware of the fact that I often work less hard than my compatriots in my graduate program. And
oh, everyone
I'm
works
afraid,
harder than me.
Yeah, I'm afraid that's going to catch up with me at some point, and I live in fear of that day. how is this manifesting for you right now, Cleo? Because we're not in undergrad anymore. And you are doing a graduate program, right? But that hasn't started
yet. It hasn't started yet, yes. But, again, going back to the blog post I read by my friend, she talks about how she can easily fall into the trap of comparing herself to other people's accomplishments and feeling, oh, well, they have everything together. They're so good at this life thing, and I brushed my hair today. that sort of thing. And so it's more in terms of just, sometimes I look around and I go, wow, I'm really bad at adulting. You know, all these other people I see, they're starting businesses and getting their degrees. And, you know, most of my friends I graduated with are finishing up their master's program and I haven't even started mine. And that was not in the plan. And I'm not, you know, changing the world like all my professors and internship people encouraged me to do. And so, what if I'm just really not good at things?
Right.
Not to invalidate this feeling that you have, but you're definitely changing the world. You do more volunteer work than anyone I know.
Agreed.
I'm serious, like, you know, the work that you do with your ESL program and the work that you do, like, just we were talking about the other day with the food bank.
Yeah.
Like, it, you are changing the world for what that is worth to you.
Yeah, but it's definitely somewhat a comparison game, especially because it's not so much that I can just look at people and compare grades now. It's more like life accomplishments sort of thing. And so,
and I think, sorry.
Like milestones?
Not even so much milestones. Just like, I'm not sitting around being like, oh, my friends are getting married and I'm not, sort of thing. It's just, and you have these moments where I feel like, I just don't know what I'm doing with adulthood. Am I really doing things? You know, how do I do this adult task? Everyone else seems to know what they're doing and I don't. And so,
No, I think that's it. Okay. I think a lot of imposter syndrome is also the feeling that no one else feels this way, especially the people who you're comparing yourself to. You just assume that they definitely do not feel this way because they are fine and you're the one that's messed up.
Yeah.
There's always been a strong association of no one else has ever done this. Everyone else who's ever come here has actually deserved it, except for me, who doesn't. And this kind of feeling of, well, those people that I compare myself to, they definitely don't feel this way, because they actually do deserve things. That kind of feeling.
Yeah.
Though I think breaking that lie that not everyone, that those people don't feel this way and can't feel this way and stuff like that, though. Actually, just earlier today, I was at this prayer group we have that we got to talking about imposter syndrome earlier today, and someone mentioned, you know, we were like kind of praying for all the new students that'd be coming, and then she prayed for all the professors and how so many of the professors here at Oxford also deal with imposter syndrome.
Wow.
And I hadn't thought about it before, but she's right. The lie that no one else feels this way, it's just me, is, I think, a big part of it.
Would you say that's the best way to counteract imposter syndrome is by remembering that everyone feels this way?
Not or just reminding yourself.
Or that most people feel this
yourself.
Way a lot of times?
I think reminding yourself can help, but actively discussing it with other people and actively meeting people who are willing to share and say, hey, me too, I think is much better than just reminding yourself. Because just reminding yourself is a lot like the whole, you know, eat your green beans, they're starving children in Africa, which is a terrible one. But I think opening up and discussing and looking for other people and helping and finding people who can help, I think is probably a good way to at least continue combating this. Right. I'm not saying it's the only thing you should do, but I found it very helpful. I've found a group of people who are okay admitting that we all feel this way, and that helps.
And one thing, I was doing a little bit of internet scrounging around while I was thinking about this section.
Okay, my new favorite term is internet scrounging. I'm gonna do that.
But, yeah, just what you said of being willing to talk about it, because I know in my life, and I'm sure I'm not alone in this, one thing I tend to do to try to combat that feeling is overcompensate.
Bad, no.
Yeah,
doesn't
and I'm
work.
Just like, okay, I'm
can
gonna...
You, wait, hang on, can you tell me what that looks like?
Just trying harder to do better and trying harder to present myself as composed. And I feel like if I'm not the only person doing this, it's probably contributing to everyone's problem, because the more we see other people doing that, the more we tend to think, oh no, I really am the only one.
Ooh, and now you make yourself feel like a faker too.
Yeah. And then you're in constant competition with these versions of people and this version of yourself that's not even real. And one of the things I was reading in one of these articles, they said that a good way to combat imposter syndrome is to remind yourself there's a difference between doing your best and being the best.
Ooh. Well, that's good.
And I was like, oh, that's really good. Because I think that sometimes in order to beat it, that's what we try to do. I have to be the best. And then I'll feel like I really do deserve to be here.
Not healthy.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Cleo, you shared a story about kind of a specific way in which this happened in undergrad. Did you want to share that?
I can.
You know, since we're talking about being open and stuff.
Well,
yeah, gee. It's good to share these kind of stories.
Yeah, so in undergrad, I felt that way more because I was in the honors program, and I was surrounded by a lot of super smart people who had done a lot of things, even before undergrad. That's kind of how you get into honors. Except for me, who had a GED and never took the SAT and got in solely based on my freshman GPA, because they didn't, I guess, look past that.
You didn't nice. Have, you had a GED because you were homeschooled, right?
Yeah, but I didn't take any of the tests that would normally people coming into honors would have to submit, like AP transcripts and SAT scores and community service stuff and all of this.
Actually, I did this job. Mm-hmm. There are only three things. You have to either have an SAT that's good enough, or an ACT that's good enough, or a GPA that's good enough.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
And you had that GPA from the online classes you did at, what is it, Liberty Online?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, generally it refers to a high school GPA, but, I mean, they could have easily made it a different one.
Because I was a transfer student, that's what they did.
Yeah.
I used to hear everyone else talk about and they made it sound like this arduous, terrifying thing that you had to go through in order to get in as a freshman. And I was just like, well, I didn't have to do any of that. And they let me in. Did I, like, sneak in? Are they eventually going to figure out that I don't know what I'm doing and I'm not as accomplished as all these other people?
You ended up on the council, too, didn't you?
I did.
The graduate. That sounds so ominous. On the council. The Jedi Council.
It was kind of like a Jedi Council.
Oh, trust me, I got onto this council by complaining too much, and then he nominated me. True story.
It's a true
story. What did you complain about?
I complained about the council.
They're like,
oh, yeah, and so then they were just like, do you want to be on it? And I was like, not really. And they're like, well, we need someone. And I was like, fine.
Yeah, I remember I didn't tell anyone that all through undergrad because I was just really, I felt like it made me less qualified than everyone else, that I hadn't done all the work and I hadn't accomplished all the stuff. And so if they knew, they wouldn't want me to be there or something.
Like they'd kick you out of the honors program or something?
Yeah. Oh, you didn't do all the other things that everyone else did? I remember council members had to go to scholarship weekend where all the rising freshmen would come to compete for these big scholarships, and they were so stressed, and they come in with their transcripts and their community service transcripts, and they were so stressed trying to impress the scholarship board. And they sent the honors council. They said, you guys will understand. You can be there for them. And I'm just sitting there going, no, actually, I don't understand at all. I'm the worst person ever. I mean, I will go and be encouraging because they're nice people and we want them to come here.
No.
And because that's a nice thing to do, but don't ask me to sympathize because I have no clue.
Oh my gosh.
And it was a shame in comparison, and looking at everyone else and going, wow, they're so good at these things and I'm so not.
Aww.
Instead of just accepting my own story and my own abilities and working on that. And I don't know, there's nothing magical. I don't have any magical solutions, again, because like I said, it's something that crops up in different ways.
Mm-hmm. I think, I mean, just sharing stories like the ones you just did were pretty good magic solution.
Yeah.
And I guess that's the thing, is really just, this isn't something you beat once and get a trophy and sit it up and then you're done with it forever.
Yeah, that's true.
Nothing in mental health is something that you beat once and get a trophy and a little achievement and then you're done forever. You know? It's really hard.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the important thing to remember is, like, guilt, feeling guilty about something bad that you did is useful because it helps you be better, but shame does nothing for you.
Yeah.
That's a good distinction, but one that's pretty hard to make in, like, life.
In the moment, it's really hard.
Well, if it's stopping you from trying again, then it's probably shame.
Right.
It's a good distinction.
That is a good distinction.
Thank you, Hannah.
Hannah's.
Haneem.
Haneem.
Haneem. The Haneem. And Rissa. Yeah, we've and all Peggy. Decided that that must be said in the Peggy tone. And Peggy.
And Peggy.
What are we into this week?
Oh, what are we into?
I was just going to tell everyone that they should send me canned food for the food bank because I'm currently into trying to find new donors.
Yeah, actually, you know what? We're into supporting your local food bank this week. Let's talk about that. Like, I feel like buying an extra can of beans or an extra thing of sanitary pads or whatever when you're out and about for groceries and then donating them is a pretty easy and chill thing to do.
Yep.
So do it.
Also baby food. Because baby food is expensive.
Is it?
Really?
It's really expensive.
Do you want to tell our listeners what you told us earlier about how many families your food bank serves?
Well, we have the capacity to serve 360 families a month. We're currently serving over 400.
Whew.
That's something you should all do. Find a food bank locally that's helping people and go, because it really changes your perspective on what you take for granted. And also, please stop sending random weird things to food banks.
Uh-oh.
Can you give us some examples?
Like Keurig cups. Just for the coffee, like the K-cups for coffee machines.
Oh,
Keurig.
Yeah.
I thought you said curry. I'm like,
I thought you
like
said curry too. And I was like, what's wrong with curry?
I like curry.
Curry's good.
No, but like Keurig
yeah.
cups.
That's very dumb. Why would you do that?
I don't know.
I mean, if you... How likely are you to be able to have a Keurig if you're, like...
I mean, you can always open enough of them to brew the coffee. Definitely did that in college. But...
really? That's funny. I never would have thought of that.
So much.
I don't really drink coffee, though, so...
But, yeah, just go and interact with people, because you'll meet a lot of cool people that way, and...
Also, shouldn't you ask, like, go to your local food bank and ask what they need
yeah, ask
before
what
you
they
just
need.
Start foisting stuff on them?
Just because people need help doesn't mean they just want random crap.
Good point.
They're actually still people, you know. If you wouldn't eat it, I mean, there are some guidelines with that, but if your first reaction is, that sounds gross, why would you force that on
Don't
someone else?
Don't do it.
Yeah. Maybe beans.
Beans. Mm. Actually, do give beans. We like beans.
What kind of beans?
Any kind of beans, really. Dry beans, canned beans.
Oh no, we're not doing a big Forrest Gump thing about beans.
Nope, we're not.
Is that a Forrest Gump thing?
This is a
no,
Pythagoras
it's shrimp
thing.
And Forrest Gump.
Thank you.
Oh, I thought we were going on, you know,
donate
the,
all
you know,
the beans
boiled shrimp.
And their souls to your local food bank. <Ugh. laughs>
Oh gosh.
Yeah, don't just donate the bodies of the beans. You have to get the souls,
yeah,
or there is
souls.
No benefit to the consumer.
Without the souls, what is even the point of eating beans?
Well, Aristotle would say that the souls are kind of the beanishness of the bean, and also what makes them alive, so I'm not sure about that.
I want to see Pythagoras and Aristotle get in a fight about the souls of beans.
It sounds like something on Monty Python.
Epic rap battles of philosophy.
Yeah!
Oh, we've missed our calling.
Oh, it's too bad the three of us can barely rap.
Yeah.
Oh, you say barely. That implies that there is a little bit. Like, there is
well,
none.
Listen, I was speaking for myself.
Okay, you can barely rap. I can just, like, anti-rap. Like, the opposite of whatever rap is. I'm not even sure I can do the opposite, to be honest. I am rap neutral.
What's your D&D alignment? Rap neutral.
That's it. That is the title of today's episode. D&D alignment, rap neutral.
No, just rap neutral. I am rap neutral.
That's way better. Oh, I love you guys.
We have fun here.
We do. So if you'd like to email us about the souls of beans that you donated to your local food bank, or about your own personal struggles with imposter syndrome, or about anything really, we would love to hear from you. You can contact us at our email address, which is the most straightforward way, at theliberalarnts@gmail.com.
New WordPress followers, so yay to them.
That is
fun.
Good.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for following us on WordPress. You can also contact us on our Facebook page, on Twitter, as The Liberal Arnts, or at The Liberal Arnts.
Nope, it's just Liberal Arnts. The Z was too long.
Yes, right. At Liberal Arnts on Twitter.
That's
and
it.
Yes. If you want to give us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening to this, that helps other people find our podcast, and it makes us look real good. Or real bad, depending on what your review says, I guess.
We won't presume that you love us.
Although, let's be honest, we're pretty lovable.
Unless you
Agreed.
Don't like beans.
Or imposter syndrome? I don't know.
I mean, I don't like imposter syndrome.
I'm not a fan myself. We'd also like to thank Caitlin Thompson for our graphics and our logo, and Tristan at Vintage Lab Tech for our music. And thank you for listening. We love you.
Yes, we do.
Do we know what we're doing next time?
We're going to be talking some more about turkey.
What else is there?
What else is
All
there?
Right, well, we hope you come back for that. But until then, learn something worth knowing.